From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, political writer Dan Kaufman looks at the legacy of the last decade of Wisconsin politics.
Then a recent study looks at the disparity between home and workplace segregation in U.S. cities.
There's not a single city in the country where residential segregation or nighttime segregation was lower than workplace or daytime segregation.
We'll speak with nationally renowned dancer and Brookfield native Emily Schoen.
And a Milwaukee area woman talks about what thriving means after weathering a tremendous loss.
I think thrive means that you deal with what's in front of you and you're honest with yourself and you're authentic and you take the help that people give you and you live the best life you can even despite life.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for listening today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Much like the physical winds here this time of year, the political winds in Wisconsin continue to shift. Following 8 years of Republican-dominated governance in the state, voters elected Democrats to fill the positions of governor and attorney general last fall. But last week, statewide voters chose the more conservative of the two candidates for state Supreme Court.
Political writer and Wisconsin native Dan Kaufman has been trying to understand the political zeitgeist of the Badger State in recent years. He joined us last year ahead of the elections to talk about what he learned in researching his book, The Fall of Wisconsin. Kaufman speaks at UW-Milwaukee tomorrow, so we're revisiting that interview on today's show. Dan Kaufman, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
So as you set about telling the story of Wisconsin's political transformation to a national audience, what was the biggest misconception you encountered about what people thought they knew about this state's story?
It's hard to say if there was any one single thing. I think what it told us is how this effort by conservatives to transform Wisconsin's politics, but also in doing so to transform the country's politics, was happening kind of through a thousand cuts. There was obviously the big battle of Act 10, which is probably the most significant and most defining. But there were many other things that were being done at this time to kind of, in my view, turn the state over to outside interests, not the citizens. It had a progressive past, a very strong and important one. It had also voted for Joe McCarthy twice. As people know, George Wallace, the Alabama segregationist governor, got his first real political start in Milwaukee.
Right. So was there always this kind of undercurrent of discord?
There was different strands, like most American states and cities. That said, it offered the country a kind of model that was unusual. I will give you a few examples. The whole kind of idea of social insurance sort of pretty much came out of the University of Wisconsin at the turn of the century. It became, some people say that most of the New Deal was actually drafted originally in Wisconsin and then was nationalized. The author of the Social Security Act was a man named Edwin Witte, and he, well, as well as a few other Wisconsinites and some other people, but he was the main driver of it, and he was a professor at the University of Wisconsin. Unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, these kind of pragmatic, progressive reforms that made life better for the majority of the state's citizens, and then, by extension, the country's citizens. The idea that a company had to have some responsibility for a worker being killed on the job. These were things that were real problems 110 years ago. And these reforms lasted and persisted. The idea of collective bargaining wasn't invented in Wisconsin, but it was the first state to grant collective bargaining rights to municipal workers in 1959 and then extended to state workers. This was by a Republican governor.
I was just going
to
say, I gather that this was really not a partisan issue. A lot of these weren't. The progressive name that we associate with progressivism, the La Follettes, were at one point Republicans.
They were Republicans, very much so. The state was thoroughly Republican. The Republican Party was founded here in a one-room schoolhouse in Ripon, Wisconsin. Now, there was a split, and eventually Bob La Follette, whom you mentioned, formed his own party, a progressive party. But the idea that you mentioned is really true, and you can even see it. Even Governor Walker claimed that Act 10 was a progressive reform. He used that word because it does have a salience in Wisconsin beyond party identity. Now, that has eroded. That's true. But I would say that if I was really struck that he still continued to use that word to describe something that none of the progressives of the previous century would argue was progressive at all. So.
A lot of this all kind of starts, at least reaches kind of the national radar in 2010. You describe the situation today as Wisconsin being kind of like a living laboratory for conservative reforms. What did conservatives on a national scale see in Wisconsin in, 2008, 2009, 2010 that made the time right for this transformation to start?
Well, you had the financial crisis, and accompanying that was the rise of the Tea Party. And they wanted to impose, libertarian Republicans, conservative Republicans have long railed against the federal government. They don't see a role for it in social programs, or at least a very marginal role. And you can see that in people like Paul Ryan, whose intellectual hero is Ayn Rand, who basically thought that this created a culture of dependency and that people should be completely consumed with their individualistic goals. That was very antithetical to the Wisconsin of the past. I think what you had in 2010 was a Tea Party wave. And Scott Walker, like many other aspiring Republicans, was almost auditioning for a role with some powerful donors, Charles and David Koch, the Bradley Foundation, who is in Milwaukee and had been a supporter of his efforts as Milwaukee County Executive, as many, I'm sure all of your listeners know. I think what you had is him creating a blueprint, particularly for attacking labor. He went further than most. And it was replicated by many places, even recently in 2017. It continues to be replicated. For example, in Iowa, they passed a very extreme version of Act 10 that even included police and fire departments. This has transformed the electorate to some degree. It has atomized the state's population. The labor movement has had problems over the years. There's been racism. There's been corruption. But it also has served an important role as a counterweight to this infrastructure of business interests and so on. And it was clearly, Act 10 was clearly a political attack, as well as everything else that Walker purported it to be.
Do you think, was there a general frustration among some with the strength of labor unions, or did Act 10 and the climate around it sort of create this general frustration?
My view is that it stoked resentment in a time of economic insecurity. Some of those feelings may have been there, but also this economic insecurity, particularly in rural areas, was decades long. You have to look at the state. For example, there were 150,000 dairy farmers in Wisconsin after the Second World War. There are now fewer than 9,000. A lot of these rural communities have been depleted. At the same time, we're producing the same amount of milk as we used to. So people, these communities are hurting. Sometimes the only people that might have health insurance in a small town, people that work for the school, the city workers or public workers. And so there was a lot of anger and Walker deliberately stoked this anger. And it was telegraphed in his inaugural address. He said the taxpayers can no longer be the have-nots and the public workers, the haves. So he was clearly engendering this rather than saying, oh, maybe we should try to work on getting health insurance for everyone.
Well, and so then when we flash forward to 2016, what did Hillary Clinton miss here? Why did the Clinton campaign not make more effort in this state? Was it just, looking at historical voting patterns?
I think they definitely missed something. I think there was an overconfidence, a hubris, if you will, about Wisconsin. And even though it had voted blue, for example, in 2004, John Kerry narrowly won it. There's a lot of things I go into in the book about that. I think there was a combination of factors. I think the state's Democrats tend to be probably to the left of the National Democrats. You saw that in the Act 10 protests. This was really the first mass grassroots political action from the left in a long time. And it was very there were huge numbers of people that sparked a kind of rethinking. At the same time, National Democrats did not really support these efforts. President Barack Obama did not come to Wisconsin to defend collective bargaining rights. And he wouldn't even make a brief stop for Tom Barrett when he was running the recall campaign. Now, Hillary Clinton, I think her record with labor was very difficult for her to sell. She was a former corporate board member of Walmart, as well as a longtime supporter of free trade agreements that have really hollowed out a lot of Milwaukee and southeastern Wisconsin's industrial base. And these issues have a huge salience across the industrial Midwest. And I think that resonated. People forget, too, that Donald Trump, in his speeches, which were marked by racial resentment and nativism, also defended the welfare state. He said, we will not, you know, Ted Cruz is going to cut Social Security. I'm going to defend it. Medicare. He also railed against NAFTA and these other agreements. So I think he was successful in Clinton's absence of peeling off a portion of the white working class.
So Wisconsin is where you grew up. In doing the reporting for this book, do you think there were fundamental things that you maybe didn't realize about your fellow Wisconsinites when you were growing up here?
Yes. I mean, I'm a journalist. I'm always interested in learning, and I learned a lot. I was reporting for 7 years, really, although the book really began in earnest after Trump's victory. But I'd written a lot of articles about the state's political battles. There was the idea that citizens should be encouraged to vote. That was a bipartisan note. The state used to have one of the most liberal voter registration policies. It was encouraged. Citizens should be participants. This was a legacy of Bob La Follette, who really encouraged active citizenship. And that was, both sides accepted that. Environmentalism, that was really a bipartisan tradition. Tommy Thompson preserved a lot of natural lands. And there were other things that seemed out of character. And I think that that is because there were these outside interests. It wasn't really driven by the state's citizens, certainly not the majority of them. But there was a receptive audience because things had been eroded for a time. That's my view.
Well, Dan Kaufman, remarkable job in showing Wisconsin to itself here.
Well, it's just it's been great talking to you, Mitch. And I'm glad to bring the book here. Anxious for people to read it in the place where these stories were forged.
Dan Kaufman grew up in Wisconsin. He now lives in New York. His new book is called The Fall of Wisconsin, The Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion and the Future of American Politics. We spoke with him last year when the book first came out.
Kaufman will talk about the aftermath of the 2018 elections tomorrow evening at the Goldemeyer Library at UW-Milwaukee. You'll find a link to more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take a quick break, and then a recent study looks at the disparity between home and workplace segregation in U.S. cities, including here in the Milwaukee area. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. There are many ways to measure segregation. In the Milwaukee area, we often hear about hyper-segregated schools and neighborhoods. But the impact of segregation can be felt in every part of our lives, including where we work.
Earlier this year, a group of researchers published a report on residential and workplace segregation in the United States. The research found that while cities throughout the country continue to be segregated, our workplaces are half as segregated.
Matthew Hall is a professor of public policy at Cornell University and lead author of the report. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about how they created it.
We were interested in understanding how segregation differs during the day when people are at work and at night when people go home. And in order to do that, we used data from the Census Bureau on commuting patterns for every city in the country, and in fact, for every neighborhood in the country. And we compared what the patterns of segregation or the patterns of the distribution of racial groups across cities how that differed at day and night. And when we did that, we found something that was to us was quite startling, that segregation during the day or during the workday was about half as large as it is at nighttime when people go home.
It was surprising how stark the difference was. Now, in most cities throughout the country, was that the case?
Yeah, in fact, it was the case in every city in the country. There's not a single city in the country where residential segregation or nighttime segregation was lower than workplace or daytime segregation.
Wow. So when you look at a city like Milwaukee versus some other cities, how does Milwaukee fare?
So on one level, Milwaukee's not all that unusual. Milwaukee has a level of nighttime segregation that is about twice as large as workplace or daytime segregation. And that's true in the vast majority of cities throughout the country, including those on the West Coast, those in the Great Plains, those in the Deep South. It's all kind of the same general pattern. What makes Milwaukee very unique is that its overall levels of segregation more broadly, both at home and at work, are incredibly high. In fact, in terms of our measure of nighttime segregation, that is the traditional measure of segregation based on where you live, Milwaukee ranks number one, is the most segregated city in the country. And so when you look at workplace segregation, Milwaukee also tends to rank really high. It's in the top five for most measures. So it is exceptional in that case that it has, you know, really high levels of segregation no matter really how you slice it.
When we're talking about workplace segregation in particular, I thought that was interesting because it seems like you look at it in a couple different ways. So, of course, workplace segregation in Milwaukee and other cities is much lower than home segregation. But when it comes to the jobs that people are doing in, you know, those buildings where they're all working, there is a disparity.
That's right. And one interesting thing that we found is that places tend to be less segregated when racial groups are more unequal. Now that might seem kind of paradoxical, and it confused us for a little while. But what it means is that workplaces or kind of the work environments, the types of areas where people spend their workday, areas tend to be more racially integrated when you have kind of a clear racial order with whites workers having kind of senior or more privileged positions and minority workers tending to support them. So it is an interesting and a somewhat troubling kind of caveat to this, to our findings about the nature of workplace segregation.
Yeah. Just to take a step back, when we're saying that Milwaukee is the most segregated city in terms of home segregation, where are the rest of the cities?
Well, I'd have to pull the data up.
Okay.
In order to look that up. But, you know, it's generally true that older Rust Belt cities tend to be the most segregated. So Detroit, Cleveland, Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Louis all tend to be in the top five, if not the top 10. And so, you know, a lot of these old industrial cities that have kind of a common history of both racial migration, in particular of the migration of African Americans from the South to the North, and similar industrial structures and economies all tend to kind of cluster together in those very in that very high range of home segregation.
I know also in your study, you looked at some variables that impact this kind of segregation, and then you looked at immigration status and the presence of military bases. But how do these things really impact segregation in cities?
So there's a number of different factors that tend to weaken segregation. And some of those are some of the institutions that have been very proactive in achieving racial integration, the military probably being the most successful of these. It's something that demographers have documented for many decades, that the United States military has probably been the most successful institution in the country at achieving racial integration. And so when we look at cities that have large military presence, it's not surprising to us that they tend to have significantly lower levels of both home and workplace segregation. And that also is, you know, tends to be true for areas that have large university communities and to some extent have large public sectors. But those are, you know, some common dynamics that we documented in this work.
So to take kind of a turn, what are the implications of this kind of segregation on a city and on its, you know, general area?
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a couple different ways to think about this. And there's reasons for optimism, and there's reasons maybe to be a little bit more cautionary. I guess the optimistic story is that, you know, we tend to focus on the degree of racial separation or racial isolation based on where we live. And, you know, that really misses the fact that in our day-to-day lives, when we're, you know, getting to work or going to the grocery store or getting on the bus or going to church or whatnot, we're actually exposed to a great deal more diversity than those common measures or the common understanding of segregation would have us believe. So, you know, what we're trying to reveal is that actually there's a great deal more exposure to diversity than we might popularly believe. And that's true in pretty much every city in the country. At the same time, it's nevertheless true that residential segregation or home segregation is really stubborn and it's really sticky. And despite the fact that it's declined modestly over the last, you know, 40 or 50 years, it's still quite high. In a place like Milwaukee, it's extremely high, and it hasn't really changed all that much in the last several decades. So, you know, there's both reasons to kind of celebrate the fact that this increased diversity that has defined the American population over the last, 30 years or so has integrated workplaces, but that it hasn't done the same thing to neighborhoods. And so that's an area where we still need to be looking for solutions.
Matthew Hall is a professor of public policy at Cornell University. He's also the lead author of a report on residential and workplace segregation, which was published earlier this year in the Population Research and Policy Review. Hall spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers last month.
Another short break, and then we'll meet Emily Schoen, a dancer and Brookfield native who helped UPath kick off this year's fund campaign to support the performing arts. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The United Performing Arts Fund kicked off its annual campaign in March to raise millions of dollars for many of the region's largest performing arts groups. Every year, the campaign opens with a special guest who has some tie or ties to the area's performing arts community, whether they got their start here or played a significant role in a performance here.
This year, Brookfield native Emily Schoen returned to the area to participate in the kickoff. Schoen graduated from Brookfield Central and is now a New York City-based dancer, choreographer, and teacher. Her range is impressive. She's performed with the Metropolitan Opera Company, the Rolling Stones 50th Anniversary Tour, and with her own group, Schoen Movement Company.
She's also a prolific choreographer and has participated in the State Department's Cultural Diplomacy Program. She's currently working on a piece to be performed in breweries. Schoen stopped by the Lake Effect Studio while she was in town for the UPath kickoff, and she explained then why she felt it was important to come back for the event.
I spent the first 18 years of my life here in the Milwaukee area learning dance and learning to appreciate art, and I wouldn't be who I am today if I didn't do that. So it's a treat to be back and lend a small helping hand in continuing to promote arts locally.
Well, particularly the performing arts, you know, because that's, of course, what UPath mm-hmm. focuses on. I think a lot of times dance gets forgotten in that equation. You know, we hear about music, we hear about theater, opera, but dance is also a performing art, and it sometimes feels like the redheaded stepchild of the performing arts.
So funny you said that. I was going to bring up the redheaded stepchild saying too, and it's funny because I'm redheaded. But it's true. Yeah, dance sometimes gets forgotten, but I think it's one of the more innate art forms. You know, you see kids and young toddlers listen to music and they can't help but move. And so it's, I think, a really unifying art form across all of humanity.
Were you one of those kids?
Of course.
Yeah. So what attracted you to, I don't know if I could safely say you're a modern dancer. You're certainly not a ballet, although you probably have ballet training.
I have ballet training, and yes, I am a modern dancer. I do consider myself a modern dancer.
So what attracted you to that particular part of the dance world?
Oh, it's a good question. Well, I grew up dancing at a studio called Accent on Dance in Waukesha. And I got a little bit of modern there, but it was when I got to college that I really dove into the modern craft. And I think it suited me because it's very physical and there's a lot of range within modern. You know, you dance barefoot typically. Nowadays, sometimes you dance in socks. But it's very grounded. It's a art form where you travel through space a lot. So you can be very physical and you can also present dramatic range too when you're performing.
One of the things I love about modern is that it gives women the opportunity to be muscular and physical and explosive across the stage, where you don't see that necessarily in ballet. You know, the gender lines are very strictly divided there. And I love how modern in its all of its forms sort of bends that.
It's so true. Even when it comes to partnering work in modern, women partner women, men partner men. You're right, the gender lines aren't as strong. And I think that's fun. I think it's fun to explore different relationships in movement, different relationships of weight sharing. And yeah, it's, you can be a little bit more kind of nitty gritty and a little bit more animalistic, I think, in the modern world, just by the nature of being a little lower to the ground, barefoot.
Right, barefoot and not in point shoes.
Yes.
And not constrained by certain, you know, well, 150 years worth of craft and things passed down,
right,
which I think makes a huge difference. I was looking at your resume, and you danced with one of my favorite choreographers, Mark Morris.
Oh, yeah.
I loved watching. Yeah. I used to, many years ago, work as a techie in a roadhouse back on the East Coast, and they had a lot of dance troupes come through, and Mark Morris was a regular. It was like every year the company would come through, and I just thought it was so, I don't know, intimate and, as you say, grounded and animalistic. And it was so expressive and beautiful,
yeah,
as well as difficult.
For sure. And one thing I love about Mark Morris's work is that he's just a musical mastermind. He knows the scores as well as the people who made the scores, it seems like. So when I danced in his piece, it was actually at the Metropolitan Opera in New York, which was a beautiful facility and a venue to work for, because it's not just about dance. That was one thing I loved working there. It's about the larger production, all these operas, these major operas, huge costumes and sets, and all the seats in the house have subtitles so people can understand what the singers are saying in many different languages. So I danced in his opera, Orfeo ed Euridice. And that's where I got to know his work a little bit more intimately.
Yeah, the Met.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
It's like, talk about bringing all of the performing arts into one thing.
Yeah, my first rehearsal, my first stage rehearsal in that opera, actually, I remember sitting down watching the chorus. And at this particular production had a very large chorus. I think it was like around 100 people. And just hearing them in person, you know, we were sitting 20 feet away while they rehearsed a particular section, I just started crying, because it was just the power of these voices from singers who are world class. You know, if you're an opera singer and you belong to the Met Opera in New York, you're doing just fine, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say, even the chorus members are world-class.
Oh, yes.
You know, you're not, just because you're not singing a lead doesn't mean that you're not fabulous. Well, and I think that's the power of the performing arts, is that it can reduce you to tears, to laughter, to just, you know, huge heart-opening moments in your life. You must take all of that when you create your own work, because you're a choreographer as well as a dancer. So you're creating and thinking about all of these things as well for your own pieces.
It's very true. You know, when I'm creatively engaged, when I'm dancing or when I'm choreographing or even seeing other performances, I think just the best version of myself. You know, I'm happy and I'm grounded and I'm centered and I engage well with others. I play well with friends. It's just, it brings out the best in me, and I think that makes all aspects of my life and my relationships better too. I totally agree with you. I think that's what the arts provide. It provides this, you know, well-rounded, kind of three-dimensional life experience.
Well, you said it, I think, a little while ago, where you say it's like the best part of you, the best version of yourself.
Yeah.
I think it does that for all of us. You know, it makes us the best people we can be in any given moment.
I think so, too. I find a lightening of my spirit. You know, if I've been behind the computer doing administrative work for my company for a while and I get back in the studio or back in my creative process, it's just a different world. And it's a great world to be part of. I feel so lucky that, you know, I have the arts and I'm able to pursue the arts. I don't know that I would be as happy or dynamic an individual if I had a normal desk job.
When you start thinking about a new dance, mm-hmm. what are the kind of sparks that will make you think, oh, I have to turn this into a piece?
That's a great question. Well, the current project that I'm doing with my company is a big one. I danced for about 8 years for an established modern dance company called Kegwin & Company. And back in 2017, we went on a really special tour. It was sponsored by the U.S. State Department and facilitated by a group in New York called Dance Motion USA, which is affiliated with the Brooklyn Academy of Music. And it was a tour to three countries in Africa. And the tour was great because the mission was quite simply cultural diplomacy, person-to-person cultural diplomacy. So the U.S. State Department had a grant where they would send out American artists on unique world tours to basically just be themselves and interact with as many people as possible. So people in other countries got to meet real Americans and not just the celebrities or not just the politicians they see on TV, and to make real connections with these, you know, normal people.
And you performed as well.
Yeah. So it was the three countries, went to Cote d'Ivoire, Ethiopia, and Tunisia. And in each area, we would perform and then also create dance with local groups and learn a little bit of their dance forms as well. And so when we got to Tunisia, it was a beautiful surprise that there actually is a professional dance scene there. Surprise. Like, who knows that? We didn't. You know, it's a small professional modern scene. There's, you know, under 100 professional dancers, but they're there and they're talented and they create in a vein not crazily different from, you know, what we do in New York. So the other thing that was pretty serendipitous about that tour is that we had a foreign affairs officer who has a background in dance. Surprisingly, you know, she, I think, studied international affairs and dance in college, and she went right into the Foreign Service and took a sabbatical at one point for a year to gig in New York. So she knew that I had my own company, you know, outside of Kegwin & Company, and she said, you know, if you are thinking about coming back, if you want to explore this relationship more, I can send you some links to these grants that are the U.S. Embassy in Tunis offers. And so I kind of scrambled filling out some of these grant forms, and we secured enough funds to go back 6 months later with my company. So long story short, that was 2017. Now we're in 2019, and we've secured artists or visas for the artists to now come to New York and to continue our collaboration. So we have an evening-length show in May with these, you know, with this international cast.
How fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, that is just a wonderful story of how diplomacy and the arts can work together. You
Absolutely.
Know? I mean, when you were a little kid in Brookfield, did you ever think that you would be bringing artists from Tunisia to New York to work on this huge collaboration?
Never. Never in a million years. It's yeah. just like one of those things that you can't even imagine, right? I didn't even really know where Tunisia was before this tour came around, you know, came to my table. It's just this beautiful country. It's like sits on the Mediterranean Sea. It's the most northern tip of Africa. And I feel so lucky that this strange and special collaboration has come about.
Well, you have to send us pictures. And, so, and post video, are you going to be doing all of that, like live tweeting or any of that?
Yeah, we're doing all the social media stuff.
Good.
It's a big deal for us. For
yeah,
sure.
How fantastic.
Yeah, so I guess back to your question. In this case, it was a very practical spark when I met these dancers and was thinking about what's next for my company, what would be a cool project to pursue. And I was like, well, this might be an opportunity to try something different, to dive in with these people who, some of whom I don't even speak the same language as, you know, dive in with movement. And we took it from there.
Fantastic. I mean, I'm getting chills. It's just, what a wonderful collaboration. And that's that cultural diplomacy is just so important.
It really is.
Yeah.
Really is. We have the technology these days with, you know, not just digitally, but with air travel, that the world is a much smaller place. And I think it's so important for us to be reminded that people everywhere are people, first and foremost. You know, we might have different politics, different religion, different whatever it is. But at the end of the day, we all inherently kind of want the same things.
Yeah. And one of those things is to move.
For sure.
So while you're here, what are your duties as the special guest for UPAV?
Yeah, well, it's a blessing to be able to kind of speak about the organizations that have helped me, especially when I was young and growing as an artist when I lived here in my childhood. And then, you know, I'm helping at the UPAV launch for their campaign, which is happening now through June. And UPAF is an awesome organization that's a single point of giving locally. So if you're interested in supporting the arts, it's cool because you can trust UPAF to take your dollars and use them responsibly and divvy them out amongst the community where needed. So it's cool to be part of UPAF, too, for this event.
Well, Emily, I want to thank you so much for coming in and talking with us. Best of luck launching the UPAV campaign for 2019, but also best of luck with all of your creative endeavors. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Emily Schoen is a Brookfield native. She's now a New York-based choreographer, dancer, and teacher, and one of Dance Magazine's top 25 to watch artists.
She was back in town to help with the kickoff of this year's UPAV fundraising campaign. You can find links to more about her and about UPAV at WUWM.com.
One more break, and then how Susan Miller weathered heartbreak and learned to thrive in its aftermath. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. It might be a cliche to say that Susan Miller dealt with a parent's worst nightmare, but it's also true. 10 years ago, Miller's previously healthy 14-year-old daughter was suddenly diagnosed with a brain tumor, and she died just days later. The following decade has been a roller coaster for Miller and her family, including meeting the woman whose life was saved by her daughter's donated organs, and then Susan surviving her own bout with a brain tumor.
But Miller's experience, while exceedingly difficult, also taught her and her family about resilience and what's known as post-traumatic emotional growth. The Milwaukee Area Woman's recent book chronicles that journey. It's called Permission to Thrive, and she joined us in the studio in February. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much, Mitch, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Why was it important for you to write this book, both important to you and important to, you hope, to the people who might read it?
Well, our family's gone through quite a tumultuous last 10 years, and we were pretty normal, average people living in Bayside and had three daughters, healthy daughters. And we had a very normal life, just like everyone thinks that they have a normal life. And we thought that the people on the news stories, the tragic news stories, were just that, people on the news. And what we found out when our daughter passed away is we were affected as well, and we learned quite a lot about how people deal with grief and death, and actually how Western civilization and our society doesn't deal very well with it.
Well, and your daughter passed away 10 years ago, and I imagine, and I gather even in as I read the book, people still aren't necessarily sure how to approach you or how to kind of deal with, you know, with this loss.
No, society is very interesting. When there's a death or an illness in someone's life, the tendency is to ignore rather than to address, because I think the person feels like if they get too close, something's going to happen to their family member. If you have cancer, is it catching? You have a daughter that dies, it's the parent's worst nightmare, and they don't know what to do because they tear up and they can't even imagine it happening to them. So I had to deal with people going to the other aisle in the grocery store because they didn't want to have to have an awkward conversation. And I had to learn pretty quickly that if I ran into someone at the coffee shop, I had to say hello to them. I had to ask about their daughter, who was the same age as my daughter had been. And then I would even bring up my daughter's name. And that it decreased the awkwardness. And I felt that was so helpful for myself and for the person.
Do you think people are also shy about it because of fear that they don't want to make you feel worse?
Absolutely. I've heard that a lot. They would say, well, I don't want to make you cry, but, and I would say, look, I'm thinking about Laura 24/7 all the time. So if you make me cry, okay, you make me cry. Maybe I needed that cry.
What did it take for you to be able to even sit down and start writing this book?
Well, after Laura died, I started writing in a journal. I had been writing in a journal on and off since I was 13. And I wanted to write down every memory I had about Laura within those first couple weeks because I knew that I would forget some of her idiosyncrasies that I wanted to remember. You know, like she liked extra cranberries on her potbelly salad, or she liked peach yogurt, those kinds of things. So I started writing, but then I realized, you know, I just didn't want to write a grief book. It was just too sad. And then when other events happened, it changed my perspective.
One of the fears that you write about from years ago was that after a year had passed, mm-hmm. you worried that people would think that you should be done grieving. But of course, you're never really done. What have you come to appreciate about the grieving process over the past decade? Even though, as you say, this is not a grief book.
I think what I've learned is that you have to understand that this happened and that, as my mother says, it is what it is. It's just a reality. It's a reality of our human existence. And even though what happened to us was incredibly rare and incredibly dramatic and tragic, it happened, and Laura wouldn't have wanted us to stop living. And we needed to parent our other two daughters, who were 12 and 9 at the time. It didn't really feel like we had a choice. We just had to keep moving forward. And if we hadn't kept moving forward, I think it would have been worse. We would have created more problems for ourselves.
One of the really remarkable aspects to your journey was not only finding out that Laura's liver saved someone's life, but getting to know that person and her story. How did that happen?
Wow. It's a pretty incredible story, and it's fairly unusual. We were asked on the worst day of our life, when we had been told that Laura had been declared brain dead, and a nurse walked into the room, a donor coordinator, and asked us if we would consider. She gave us the first condolence that we received, which was very, very difficult to receive. And then she asked very kindly if we would be considered donating Laura's organs. And we didn't know really what to think at that moment because she had been in at school just on Tuesday. And then she was basically in ICU, hooked up to all the machines on Wednesday. And by Saturday, she was declared brain dead. So the thought of donating her organs when she had just been alive and healthy was sort of unfathomable. So when we decided to donate them, our 12-year-old daughter actually was in the room at the time, and she was the one that said to us, "Mom and Dad, if it could save someone's life, how can you not donate it? How can you not donate her organs?" So a couple days later, we found out that a woman had received her liver, and that was pretty special. But we were still in grief, so we couldn't really comprehend it. And then 2 months later, we got an anonymous thank you letter from her.
Right. I think you're right that at first you were just under the impression that this was a generic letter that, all relatives of organ donors receive. And it was only after your family told you you have to read this that that you realized that this was actually from the person who received your
daughter's liver. Yeah. That was a strange thought that went through my mind. But so after we received this letter and all of the identifying information had been blacked out, because that's what the rules are. You have to wait a year until after the organ donation is made before the donor family and the recipient family decide that they want to waive their confidentiality. And so we started sending pictures of our family back and forth through the donor networks. And then 18 months later, to the day that I had brought Laura to the hospital, I received a white envelope in the mail, and it had Trish O'Neill's name in it. So this was the woman that received my daughter's liver, and we had her contact information. So that night, my family went out to dinner, and we were all talking excitedly because we wanted to connect with this woman, and we called her that evening.
I can't even imagine what that must have been like. I mean, I guess I can imagine because you write about it. But,
yeah, it's a very unusual story, and we were very nervous. I was extremely nervous. We all got on phones in different parts of the house, and my husband dialed and talked to her husband answered, and then when he gave the phone to her, she had tears in her voice, and she was so great. She's a special education teacher for 5- and 6-year-olds, and she knew exactly how to talk to our daughters. She asked them about themselves. She told them about how appreciative she was of the gift. And when we got off the phone, the girls were dancing around the kitchen. We were actually so happy that something good had come out of something so horrible.
Well, and of course, the other phenomenon you describe is having had this horrible thing happen and this constant underlying fear that more bad things would happen. And then it turned out that you did have to cope with a medical challenge of your own.
This is the stranger than fiction part. So we had gotten ourselves back to normal. We were parenting our children. We were traveling. We were doing all the things that parents do. And right around the second or third week of September in 2012, I began having headaches. And I just blamed them on stress and all different kinds of things. And, because we'd get headaches, and then I took Tylenol, and it would go away, and then it would come back. And then I would take a glass or two of wine at night, and it would go away, and then it would come back early in the morning, early in the middle of the night. And I didn't really want to tell my daughters, I didn't want to tell my husband that this was starting to concern me because moms are not the ones that are supposed to have the medical issues. We're the ones that are supposed to stay strong. And finally, I got to the point where I went to an MRI, and the radiologist basically took me into his little cubicle and said, "Susan, I can't sugarcoat this." And he pointed to the MRI image, and you could see a white amoeba-shaped blob on the screen. And he said, "I'm sorry, but you have an aggressive tumor." And that's exactly the wording that was used when my daughter was diagnosed. It's a scary moment.
Absolutely. But we should note that you are here.
That is because even though we were both diagnosed with tumors, Laura's was called a medulloblastoma, which is a very rare childhood, very aggressive brain tumor that typically is always deadly. It only comes in stage 4, whereas my tumor is called a meningioma, and it's much more common. It occurs, in women that are between 40 and 70 mostly, and it's not as serious. If you're going to get a brain tumor, this is the one that I've been told.
It's a run-of-the-mill brain tumor.
But mine was pretty large, and because it was causing headaches, the radiologist told me, you need to go to the hospital right now. And that's what my husband did. He drove me to the hospital, and I had to check myself in to the hospital by myself because he had to run back and meet my two other daughters at home and tell them that their mom now had a brain tumor. I didn't envy what he had to do that day. But for all of us, it was pretty darn scary.
I imagine he did not envy what you had to do that day.
No, that is true. But he's been a rock for all of this.
Well, and so in the end, or at least the end of these pages, the title of the book is Permission to Thrive. So what is your working definition of thrive?
That's a good one. I think thrive means that you deal with what's in front of you and you're honest with yourself and you're authentic and you take the help that people give you and you live the best life you can, even despite life. And I think sometimes we forget that troubles happen in life and troubles happen to everyone. And it's really how you respond to them, because life throws you curveballs all the time. And we all know people, everyone we know has some trouble. Not everyone talks about it. Not everyone is so blunt about it like I've been. But I've learned that the more you take from the community that wants to support you, the better you survive. And I would say that I've thrived because of the community and because I'd volunteered for many years and we'd put ourselves out there into the community, and the community came to us and they rallied behind us, and that made me feel very grateful.
Do you think you realized this before you wrote the book, or do you think that understanding those kinds of lessons came through the process of writing this?
Well, I think the one piece that I learned through writing and thinking about what the book was about and thinking about what the title was going to be about is I came upon the word permission. And the permission is what really stuck out at me, because it was really only myself that could give myself permission to defy what society expected. I mean, when you lose a child, I think our society thinks that we're supposed to go crumble and hide under the covers for the rest of our life, and that we should be miserable for the rest of it. And I mean, people would have understood if we did that, but that's not what we wanted for the next 40 or 50 years. And so I had to give myself permission to do things that I might not have wanted to do in the past. I really had to give myself permission to do whatever we needed to get through the day and to get through the week and to get through the next year.
Well, I'm so glad you went through at least the book writing process. Well, at the same time, I'm so sorry that, you know, all of these things happened that you had to.
Well, people will often say to me, I'm so sorry that this happened to you, and how can you handle this the way you are? You're an inspiration, all of that. And I think, yes, we've dealt with it well, but we've also learned so much that I still feel lucky. I feel really grateful for every day. I could have died from the brain tumor. I could have been divorced by this point. Our family could have broken apart, and it hasn't. And in fact, we all feel stronger, like we have more purpose, like we understand that just because I think the suffering kind of helps with the joy. The joy becomes greater, and that is what post-traumatic growth is all about. And it's when I learned that post-traumatic growth concept existed. It's a positive psychology term that really revolutionized the way that I could cope. You know, like I heard the term and my shoulders just relaxed, because I knew I wasn't alone in having experienced thriving, even in despite of a tragedy.
Well, Susan Miller, I wish you and your family many more years of thriving.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being here.
Susan Miller's book is called Permission to Thrive, My Journey from Grief to Growth. There's a link to more about the book and about organ donation at WUWM.com. There are currently more than 2,000 people in Wisconsin on the waiting list for organs. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll listen again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.